From Orange County, California, you are listening to Taking Flight with Captain Michael Rocket Blackstone. That almost sounds like a fake name. Maybe Marvel's next superhero? Might want to check into that. This is a different type of aviation podcast that is not hosted by a tech geek know-it-all or communist sympathizing wacko, no. Lucky for you, I am your host. With over 30 years and 30,000 hours of flying high-performance aircraft all over the world, 21 years at a major airline, and with over 25 years in the extremely challenging flying business, I hope to become your personal coach to get you started in your career in aviation as a pilot and to help you identify and survive this industry's many pitfalls and booby traps along the way. This podcast is my personal commitment to helping you succeed in making your dreams of flying for a living or as a hobby come true. We're trying to avoid that happening to your career, because that's gotta hurt. Well, welcome back. You are listening to Taking Flight with Michael Rocket Blackstone. We are on episode number 15 tonight, and tonight we're going to be talking with a good friend of mine and a fellow pilot who is a 767-300 co-pilot for a major airline. He also owns a... He's calling me in right now. He also owns a Pitts S2A and is going to share with us his experience with flying that Pitts S2A back from someplace in the Midwest, a bunch of landings and legs coming back to California. And with me tonight, we have Art Coral. Art, you are on the show tonight with Taking Flight with Michael Rocket Blackstone. How you doing, buddy? I got a little technical difficulty here. Standing by. Let's see. Should have been coming through. And there you go. There you go. Should be coming through now, Art. You're with me on the Taking Flight with Michael Rocket Blackstone. How you doing tonight, buddy?
I'm doing good, Mike. It sounds like it's fading in and out. I'm not sure what's going on.
Okay. I'm showing a pretty solid signal here with you. And go ahead and give me a three count. Let me make sure I've got you. Go ahead and go for it.
One, two, three.
I've got you. Cool. Welcome onto the show, Art. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Yeah, great talking to you.
Awesome, man. I just heard that you had purchased a Pitts, and it's an S2A. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I picked it up in Illinois. Actually, flew it all the way across country a couple weeks ago.
Oh my God! The S2A, what year is that thing? What year is it?
It's a 1981 model. It's got the longer front main landing gear, the wider fuselage, and has a pretty nice set of balanced ailerons with spades.
Sweet. 1981. That really brings back some memories. My dad bought a 1981 S2A brand new from the factory in 1981. And, what an awesome airplane. That is literally the first airplane I believe I ever had my hands on. I was 8 years old in an S2A. Wow. It's an awesome machine. Can you tell me a little bit about what brought you to that thing and what it's like to fly it in 2020?
Well, what I like about the airplane is, you know, the wing loading pretty light. It's basically a larger airframe than the S1, without a lot of compromise on gross weight. It's only maybe a couple hundred pounds heavier. They didn't put the big power plant in it. So it kept the weight down. So it keeps the plane feeling light and relatively floaty, kind of like the S1 feels. There's also a lot of cost efficiency to it. You're not spending money on the extra gas and taking care of those extra cylinders.
Sweet. Yeah. The S2A is an awesome machine. I believe it has, 200 horsepower in the front of that thing?
Yeah. AIEO 360 angle valve engine.
So it's four cylinders. Is that right? It's a light combing. Four-cylinder light combing?
Four-cylinder light combing. That's right.
Sweet. What an awesome airplane. You know, knowing that you flew that thing back from Illinois, you know, I have to say, you know, like when I bought my C model Pitts, I didn't have a lot of currency in the thing. And I was on the East Coast taking off out of a place called Brookhaven, New York on Long Island, and flew it all the way across the country. And I know the thing doesn't have very much range. And we're literally talking in the C model, which has a little bigger engine, so it burns more fuel. They added another tank to the top wing, which gives us only 5 more gallons, and it's only good for cross country. So you don't have that top tank in the A model, do you?
No, it's only good for about 23 gallons. And I was also breaking the engine in, so I was running it pretty rich. I was burning, you know, north of 12 gallons per hour. So it meant stopping every hour.
So yeah, so with it was burning about 14 gallons an hour, something like that, all the way 12 to 14.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, so, you don't want to run it too lean, just to get the engine broken. So yeah, lots of stops.
So less than 2 hours of fuel on board to flame out, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you plan for every hour, and that gave you 30 extra minutes to go to your alternate. If something went screwball on each leg, it's an every hour landing machine, isn't it?
Pretty much. Yeah. But I didn't mind. It's not the most comfortable ride for a long distance flight. So stopping every hour was okay.
That's okay. Yeah. So the straight up and down seating, it just brings back memories. You know, when you get in this thing, for those of you that haven't flown in a Pitts before, you wear this airplane. It's not really a plane that you climb into and you've got, you know, plenty of room. You know, Art is a pretty big guy. So getting in there, it's shoulder to shoulder. Your shoulders touch both sides of the fuselage, don't they?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you're pretty vertical seating. So your lower back, it's a little sore, and yeah, it's definitely not the most comfortable experience, but such a cool airplane, definitely worth flying it that long anyways.
Right. So the straight up and down seating, so being narrow in the fuselage area is kind of cool, because you can look out both sides. And when you sit into this tandem seat style airplane, and then the Pitts, for those of you who don't know, you fly it from the back seat. The front seat of the Pitts in the original S2A model was open cockpit, and the back seat was a tiny little bubble canopy that slid over just the aft cockpit. So it was a tiny little canopy, but I think that later they switched over in the B's anyway, they switched over to the double bubble canopy, which is what I had on my C model. Have they made that modification on your A, or do you have the small windshield and the small canopy? What's on yours?
No, it's a double canopy. But the airplane also could be modded to a completely open cockpit. So, you can fly it either way.
Oh, that's cool. So one of the coolest things about flying the S2A model, which I thought was fantastic when I was, just a youngster flying in the front seat of that thing, sitting on a bunch of telephone books to get me high enough to see out the window. And I had my, you know, the seat bottom parachute that came with the airplane, which was the red one with kind of it looks like when you're wearing it, you got like a diaper on anyway. So you're sitting in this thing, and to get up high enough in this thing, I had to sit on a lot of books, but then you're outside. So you got the wind going by. I think I was wearing the David Clark with the rag top, you know, it was made out of like a canvas and goggles, and you have to strap the chin strap. Cause my dad and I learned the hard way with another guy that he took for a flight in it. He flew it with the front cockpit, you know, of course, open, and they forgot to snap the chin strap on the guy that rode in the front seat, and they went upside down, and the wind caught the guy's the front of the lip of the headset and took it off his head, literally just ripped it clear off his head. And then of course the helmet caught more wind and it went farther out, and then it plugs in the right front. I think yours probably does too. The right front plug for where the David Clarks would plug into the panel, and it just pulled the plugs right out, and the helmet flew out of the airplane, lost it. So be careful with that when you put your first person in the front seat. Make sure they snap that chin strap, especially if you fly it in the open cockpit regime. It's kind of crazy. But hey, the thing I'm thinking about now is now that you bought this thing, you're sitting in Illinois. Tell me about that first first leg, I know there had to be some kind of exciting moment as you travel across the country in a Pitts, because you're pretty much a fuel critical, because almost take off with a fuel emergency on every flight, but you're fuel critical and you're heading west. How did you figure where your first landing was going to be?
So it was, you know, it was an interesting thought process. You know, leaving in, you know, before the winter starts to fly a plane cross country, you know, the weather is only going downhill from that point forward going into the winter months. So I had to get it moved pretty quickly, but I also didn't want to do the whole get home itis thing. The day I was leaving, or the day before I was leaving, there was a trough running north and south all the way from Texas to Canada, and the trough was creating some pretty strong winds that were gusting and against the route of flight. So going south wasn't really a great option. Normally it would be, but there were a lot of headwinds and really bad, you know, bad weather going south through down to the southeast corner of Kansas and proceeding westbound. So instead of going that route, I went due west across Iowa and then to the northwestern side of Kansas and then down to New Mexico. And you know, taking off, it wasn't that bad in the morning. The first leg was all right, and I thought by the second leg, a lot of the heavy winds would have sort of dissipated. But the second leg got a little scary coming in the land. The runway I picked out had some pretty stiff crosswinds, direct crosswinds that were gusting up to 30 knots, and it was beyond my capabilities. I went in for a couple of low approaches, and I couldn't get enough wing down and top rudder to keep the airplane straight without enough of a crab where the plane would have landed and I probably would have flipped it over on the runway.
So, oh, wow. So this was in Kansas?
No, this was in Iowa.
You're in Iowa still. I forget you. What was the distance from your first takeoff point to the an hour? Was it 150 miles down the road, maybe, if that?
Yeah, that's about right. They were about 130 nautical miles each leg.
Wow. So there you are, 130 miles west of where you took off, low on fuel, or getting there, and you realize that there isn't enough capability in the airplane to stop the crosswind. If I remember correctly, in my C model, the demonstrated crosswind, I think, was only like 15 miles per hour, which is so low. The plane could do more than that, but they hadn't really demonstrated that. So anything beyond 15 miles per hour, you're kind of on your own, and it'll do more. But I think 30 would exceed my capability and the Pitts and the C model's capability as well. So that's the only runway you got. It's a direct crosswind. So either runway you try isn't going to work. And now what?
Yeah. So at that point, I just decided to give up on that. And I proceeded further west. There were several small runways to the west. I picked a runway that favored the winds better, and I managed to get there and get on the ground. When I checked the tank, I had 3 gallons remaining.
Oh my gosh! So that's pretty scotia on gas, and you know it's not uncommon. So when you fly a Pitts, there's those who have and there's those who will reach the limit of what its fuel capability is at some point. In this particular case, you had planned for an hour and then ended up flying for probably closer to almost like an hour and 45 or so, right? Till you can get to the next airport that may have wind that's suitable. And it got pretty sketchy, didn't it?
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, I planned for that contingency, so it worked out okay, but it was still scary. I don't like going into that double fault scenario, you know, where I'm looking for an alternate, and also, you know, have still contending with some pretty severe winds, but fortunately the winds were more favorable. They were closer to down the runway, and it worked out okay.
Wow, that's pretty wild. And then I remember every time I flew my Pitts back across the country for 26 landings to complete the full transcon from the Northeast to the West Coast. Again, stop. I had a little bit more fuel, but the plane was a little thirstier, so probably averaged out to about the same thing. I landed about in every hour, hour 15, hour 20 max. And when I get there, you have this little problem with the fueling of this thing, because you can't really get the fuel nozzle into the tank, straight shot, because right above the fuel tank is the second wing. It's a biplane. So you go to put your fuel nozzle in, and you need this. We had to make a special hose for ours. I think it was about 18 inches long, clear tube that you can get at Home Depot. And then it's, I don't know, an inch and three quarter, maybe inner diameter, that fits over the nozzle of a fuel spigot. And then you shove it all the way in there till it makes a nice seal on the top of the nozzle. Then we bend that thing in, shove it into the fuel tank, making a nice curving 90 degree arc down into the fuel. And then I had to mark the hose, about 3 inches, 4 inches from the very end of it, so I can get this visual of it backing up. And that's the way you fuel it. And then I'd have to go till it backs up, and then pull it out 2 inches and go till it backs up again. Well, if you put the fuel in too fast, two really bad things happen. One is it overflows and sprays the fuel right in your face. And then it goes into the cockpit too, which is another nice feature. But it's really difficult to get the fuel right. So what we do is you try to get to know how many gallons are going to go in, and then you can kind of tame it down when you get closer to the last 4 or 5 gallons, and then ease it up. Is that kind of the way you fueled it each time in your pits?
Yeah, pretty much. I didn't mind it running over a little bit, though. I wanted to make sure I had more than enough. So
you got every drop in.
There was a little bit that spilled out. It didn't bother me.
Not too bad. Okay. Does it have that funny that funny fuel cap that goes on, and you have to screw it on, screw it tight, hold the bottom and screw the top, and then flip the lever down to hold it tight with just friction?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a big plug with the, where you push the lever down, it causes that big giant rubber gasket to expand and get tight in the tank.
You'll be careful with that. I took a friend of mine, Skip Stewart, for a ride in my pits, and we did just that. And after a while, when that friction starts to wear out, we managed to get it in and turn it as tight as it'll go. But then I flew with Skip Stewart, and he gave me a -5 push. We went inverted, and he jammed the stick forward, and we didn't apparently get the fuel cap tight enough to tolerate all that fuel slamming against the fuel cap, and the cap came off in flight. And it siphons the fuel straight overboard under the windshield, mind you. Of course, now Skip's in the front and gets fuel under the windshield, past his sunglasses and into his face, and not good. So that fuel cap is kind of good.
Did the fuel cap come off?
It came off. It was gone. He jammed it so hard fuel cap departed the airplane, and he got a face full of fuel. So for future reference, if you ever fly big negative G's or think about it, make sure you cinch that thing all the way down and pull up on it to make sure you can't pull it out. And if you can, -4 may push it out of the hole. So watch out for that. But yeah, the fueling was a little tricky. And then did you use a hose? You had to use the little hose, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But on my trip, I forgot it after, I think, I don't remember how many, 4, 5, 6 legs down the road, and I was trying to make good time, and I ended up leaving that dang fuel hose that I need to fuel it at one of the fuel stops. And of course, you don't notice it till you're 150 miles down the road and you left it. You're like, oh no.
Oh boy.
Huge mistake. So you didn't have that happen. You kept your fuel cap with you the whole way? I mean, fuel hose, the hose.
But you always wonder when you're sitting in that seat, did you leave something behind, because you're so busy thinking of everything else, did you leave your credit card, the fuel hose, did you get the cap on, did you put the oil cap back on, did you get all the bearing fasteners tight, all that stuff.
I think it's the every hour landing part. So we're landing so often in this thing that you're repeating the same process over and over. And like you said, did I get the credit card? Did I pull it out of the machine? I know I got it last one and the one before, but what about the one I just did? Now you're thinking where is it? And you got to find it. So you're constantly doing this check of, do I have my wallet, my phone, my fuel hose, my parachute? Is everything, and to use the restroom, because you're going so often to land that you almost forget if you've done that. And There were a couple stops where I didn't use the restroom. I'm usually trained Pavlov's dog. I use the restroom at every stop, you know, whether I need it or not. I don't want to be airborne and have to go to the bathroom. And then we fly so many legs in this thing in a day that I don't think you can go to the bathroom, you know, 9-10 times in a day, maybe not today. And you get dehydrated while you're flying too. So it was kind of cumbersome to keep track of all of these things that we need on each stop, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Lots of moving parts.
Crazy, crazy. So you're making this trip across the country. You're flying an S2A. You used to have an S1, didn't you, before this?
Yeah. So the airplane before this was a Christian Eagle, and before that was an S1. And of course, I trained with you in the STC. You taught me how to fly the pit.
Is it similar to the C model? It's been so long since I've flown the A that I don't recall the differences now in terms of how it felt in my hand. What are some of the differences that you're noticing between the A model and the C model?
Well, you know, it's a lighter feeling airplane because it's lighter weight, you know, and it doesn't have the power. I mean, the C has just unreal power with that big giant prop and engine pulling you along. So you don't have that, but it's a very nimble aircraft. They basically said that, you know, the C was a correction for all the mistakes they made in the B, and the A was done pretty well, and they just wanted more power, so they went with the B model, which is basically the A with added horsepower, and then they evolved the B into the C, and then the C was a correction of all that. So the C flies really well, and the A does too. It's a really good flying airplane, Not quite as much power, maybe not as much forward straight and level airspeed, but other than that, it flies wonderfully well.
I can't wait to try it. I'd love to come out if you'd have me. I'd love to come out and fly the thing, and maybe we'll do a podcast on another occasion where I'll give the full report of the A model of how it flew for me compared to how I remember it from when I was a little kid. And I'd love to fly it. Maybe I can come out and fly with you one of these days. Would that be okay?
Oh, of course. That'd be great.
Sweet. I'd love to fly it. I want to see how it lands in the shorter landing gear and closer couple. They're narrower and lower, aren't they?
Well, the gear is tall, so it's got the tall landing gear like the C, but it's got the tall gear with a lot more prop clearance, so that feels very comfortable landing.
Oh, okay.
You never have to worry about wheel landing and getting a prop strike because of how far the prop is above the ground.
Sweet. So how does it track? Pitts gets a terrible reputation for being squirrely and hard to land. Is it any of that, or is that most of that folklore?
You know, I'm pretty new with the airplane. I got the Eagle down to a science landing that. The A, I'm still struggling with consistency on my landings, so it's still a work in progress.
What's your best style? What are you noticing is the technique that you use that seems to be most least scary, should I say, most predictable and least knees knocking? Because I know that the pits can be so sketchy at times when you get out of it that you could be like adrenaline rush. You could literally be shaking coming out of that thing because it can be hairy. Does it this thing do that to you at all, or is it just me?
Yeah, I mean it's different. So you know, you can always rely on a safe, you know, a 3-point landing or even you know, hooking the tail first when you come in. But with the way the gear is so tall, the angle of attack is so high doing a 3-point that you it's really easy to hit the mains first. So bouncing's not so hard to do with this airplane, because as soon as you hit the mains first and the tail comes down, the angle of attack increases and you fly again. So it creates sort of this bounce oscillation. So I'm starting to think with because the gear is so tall in this, that the preferred way to land is doing a wheel landing with this airplane. Just dropping one of the mains with a little left roll or right roll into the wind and then settling on the main and then bringing the tail down. Just because the 3-point, it's really tough to get it. So you nail the 3-pointer, you get the tail wheel first. And if you don't do that, you end up bouncing a little bit.
Interesting. Yeah, I kind of found that to be true to the C model as well. And the C is a little trickier because it has that big carbon propeller, the three-bladed Hartzell claw, which acts like a giant speed brake. And you don't feel that on yours, do you? Like, you don't feel that crazy drag when you go to absolute idle on the A model?
No, not as much, but it's there for sure. I mean, sometimes I'll land with a lower RPM just so it doesn't drag as much. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's not nearly as apparent as the C model when you go to full RPM, and it is like hitting the brakes. So it's not quite that bad.
So what's the approach speed on this thing? Talk me through a base to final, you know, downwind to beam, 1,000 feet above the ground. What's the profile look like in the S2A?
You know, it's pretty much 90 all the way around, 90 over the numbers, and then just bleed the speed off until you connect. You can come in faster, but 90 over the fence is desired. Otherwise, you're just going to eat up a lot of runway.
Okay, so that's really similar to the C. I think I use 100 in the C, probably because of that prop. So when I finally close the throttle all the way, or if I am power off all the way in base to final, I'll use that extra, you know, 10 miles an hour because it feels like it's decelerating in the dive in towards the runway with the throttle completely closed. So I'll use a little more speed to have something left to work with at the end. It's kind of the way I do it. And then I'm doing similar to you. I would do a tail low wheel landing at 100. I'm a touch fast. So it would be, you know, that same style that, you know, you get over the fence, wings are level, touch of aileron into the wind, catch the upwind wheel, get the other main on, and then derotate the tail to catch the other one shortly thereafter. So it's touch and then stick all the way back. And then with the rudder pedals, is it a lot of left, right, or are you waiting for something, or do you literally actively work in your feet the whole way through the rollout like I do in the sea?
Definitely working the feet, probably a little bit more than the Christian Eagle, and maybe even a little bit more than the S1, which is surprising. And I'm not sure why. It could be the difference between the spring gear and the bungee gear. The spring gear tends to bounce more. The bungee gear is much softer, but it seems like the yaw oscillation might be a little bit higher with the bungee gear than the spring gear.
So yeah, the A model has the bungees like the C does, doesn't it? It's not a fixed gear like a spring steel, or like the extra 300 has that spring carbon piece. They're all bungees like a cub almost, with the bungees inside the belly.
Right. And so I've got a, you know, a certified classic pits, and all the experimental pits they tend to go to the spring gear because a little bit more aerodynamic. It's you know, better airflow over those.
Interesting.
But, the bungees are definitely softer on touchdown, which is nice. You don't tend to bounce as much, you know, from just that sort of that hard bowling ball effect you get with the spring gear. But for whatever reason, they think they lend themselves to a little bit more rudder required just to stay on center line and keep the nose tracking straight.
Interesting. Yeah, the ailerons are a little different shape, and the wingtips are different shape, and they don't run the ailerons all the way to the tip on the A model. They stop a little short, don't they, on the A model?
Yeah, that's right. And they're not full length. They're obviously, they probably start at you know, 1/3 of the wing down.
Okay, so there's a little less aileron, but in order to compensate for that, what did they do? Did they add something under the wing?
Yeah, there are spades on them. So it's got fantastic roll rate, faster than my S1 for sure. It's probably close to 270 degrees per second. If you're rolling at 140 miles per hour or more, which is just surprising for an early model. You know, it's not until you get to the sea that you start seeing the nice roll rates again, or the guys that are doing the really crazy wolf mods, or the, you know, some of the other pits out there that have the real fast roll rate.
Wow, yeah, the 270 per second is really fast, and being able to achieve that level of roll rate at a cruise speed, and you could still get it. You can still get a pretty sporty roll rate, even all the way down to the 90 or sub 100 for sure, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. But it feels fast. I mean, when you're in that 270, it starts feeling quick. At 180, it feels a little slow, but that's kind of the common, S1 roll rate, unless you're snapping it.
Well, yeah, that roll rate was really spiffy back in the early 80s. And even the C model, I think they advertise right around 300 degrees per second. I'm not sure it's quite that fast. I think it's maybe a little slightly optimistic. So when you've flown both of them, after the C model you flew with me and the A model, it's not remarkably different, is it? They're really pretty close.
It's pretty close. I think it goes back to they made the A, then they made the B, and then they said, well, we made some mistakes, so let's fix it on the C.
I kind of missed the aileron boost. For those of you that aren't familiar with what a spade is underneath the wing, it's like a little shovel that goes underneath the wings and it catches air. So if you can imagine it like the shovel in the yard, if you put the left aileron up, so we're going to roll to the left. If I put the left aileron up, the ailerons come up on the left side, but this shovel is coming down into the wind and it's helping to catch the air and take some of the weight off, almost like power steering for your ailerons. And it's doing the opposite on the other side. So if you're rolling into this thing, it's grabbing down on the left and up on the right. And the combination of those two things is giving this thing an enhanced feel, a lighter feel in the stick, which makes the ailerons feel really, really nice in your hand. And they took that off for the C model. They had them on the B too. They took them off and I'm kind of like, why do you want to make it feel heavier on the aileron? And they say it's for some kind of a balancing thing. They wanted it to have more authority in the aileron, but they didn't want it to be light in the aileron, but heavy in the elevator. Tell me about the elevator in the A, does it feel heavier than the aileron, or is it they're pretty close? What's the balance in the stick feel like?
The controls are pretty balanced on the A as far as aileron and elevator. The rudder takes quite a bit of force, I found. That probably stands out a little different. Doing a snap roll in the A, it takes a good strong punch of the rudder to get it to snap over. Mm-hmm. The Christian Eagle and my S1, a lot lighter rudder input to get it to do a snap. So that's a big difference. But the elevator and the ailerons are very balanced.
Cool. Yeah. I love the shape of it. And for a while there, I was thinking that when they squared off the wingtips of the C, that they kind of took away some of the beauty of it. I think the rounded wingtips, like the rounded wingtip of a Waco, there's just something magical and cool about a biplane with the perfectly symmetrical wingtips that it gives us this beautiful butterfly almost shape to it. And the C, they kind of cropped everything. The wingtips are squared and the tail square and the elevator square. So it kind of changed the whole look of the airplane. I really love the look and the shape of your A, and it's a prettier airplane, isn't it? It's a beautiful shape.
Yeah, I really like it. The dihedral on the bottom wing also, I think, looks really cool. And the climb rate's really respectable. I mean, it really truly gets 900 feet per minute climb rate, with that small engine and that higher gross weight than the S1. It's not the 2,700 feet per minute you get in the C model, but it's not that far off. It gives you sprightly performance for what it is.
It's a steep climb out. I don't care what airport that you're flying out of, and when you see a Pitts take off, no matter what model it is, the S1 is steep. When Mini flies his S1 out of Orange County, I remember seeing that dang thing take off, and he is no kidding at 1,000 feet midfield and turning crosswind at the midfield point. It's impressive. And I think when you get a chance to fly something like this, I'm hoping everyone that's listening, you can find Art. He's got his Pitts out at, is it, it's French Valley, isn't it?
It's French Valley. Yeah.
Yep. You find Art. We're going to leave his contact info. If Art, you want to, give it to us in the comments, or if you want to put your contact info in the, in the podcast itself, you're welcome to. We could do that anytime you're ready. But I still got some more questions for you. But we want to give you people a chance to fly the Pitts. I think it's important that all pilots get a chance to fly this thing for the aerobatic capability, for the tailwheel aspect of it. Flying tail draggers is a challenge, but don't just do it for the challenge of it. Just know that it's something that makes you a better pilot. And we always say that. I think, why does it do that? Like, well, it's because it makes you do things perfectly. The Pitts doesn't hide anything. If you're going to get a crappy landing, it's going to be a crappy landing. If you're going to get a great landing, it's going to be a great landing. If you do an acro and it comes out perfect, you're going to get a perfect acro. And if you're a little sloppy that day, it's not going to hide it. So it really does that part of making a pilot feel so much part of the airplane that it becomes part of you. And I think that's something every pilot should feel. If your plane feels like it's masking your errors, don't let that go to your head as I'm just great. Maybe you have a great airplane that's awesome, but you know, the Pitts will help hone those skills that not everybody gets a chance to try. So I highly recommend everybody get a chance to go out and fly the Pitts with Art, or wherever you could find one. If you could find one, there's just not that many of them around. And I admire guys that take the time to learn that skill and then sharing that with other people. So not only getting a Pitts and flying it by yourself, an S1, I get that, but being able to share it with other people so that they can get those tail dragger skills, which are kind of becoming fewer and farther between. And then also the unusual attitude and spin training, which the Pitts is amazing at. It was the King Kong and is King Kong of the aerobatic training world. The two seat versions, the S2As, the S2Bs, and the S2C, all amazing aerobatic training aircraft. And then they can compete. So if you ever like and fall in love with this thing, you know, once you learn to fly it in a two seater, get yourself a two seater so you can share it with other people too. But go compete with it and go see how far you can take your flying skills to the next level. And I think that's something that it's not pitched enough in aviation, that it's not about being a thrill seeker, even though my company was called Sky Thrills. It's really more about the honing of a skill, and Art's doing that in his Pitts, and highly recommend everybody get a chance to try that. The rest of the trip went smooth. You'd had nothing scary happened on the rest of that trip, and that it was just fun. Any highlights? Did you see anything cool while you're out there? What was the routing? Give us the quick routing so any of us who's interested, we can if you have it in front of you, if you have your logbook. But what were the names of the airports along the way so people can kind of follow that path and see what's out there, what's worth looking at?
Let me pull that up. I've got it here. 1 second. Let me pull it up.
I couldn't find mine either. I looked in my logs and it's pretty far back there. My logbook would have shown, it took several days and I don't think I broke down, but I had a radio problem somewhere I took the northern tier. I was on my way from Long Island, New York, and I wanted to stay in the northern half of the country because I was taking it to Portland, Oregon. So when I first bought my plane, I somebody told me it was a great idea that you can bring your plane out of state and leave it there for a year and save on the sales tax or something like that. So if you can be away from your Pitts for that long, I suppose it's doable. I don't know if that tax incentive is even still available anymore, but I did that at that point and brought this dang thing to Portland, Oregon, and left it there and flew up, you know, twice a month to go try to fly it and go scare myself some more in the pattern working around the windy, you know, the Northwest, which gets that crazy wind through the Columbia River Gorge, which I can tell you a story about that later. But the northern tier of flying this airplane across the northern half of the country was sketchy. And as you get across, you know, past, you know, the Mississippi River there, and you kind of cross to the west, the wind gets crazy, and then you end up with the terrain I landed on both sides of the of Yellowstone. I landed on the East Yellowstone and then the West Yellowstone. Flew over that incredible that beautiful mineral deposit in Yellowstone National Park. I mean, to see this stuff from your Pitts flying along solo was incredible. I prior to that, I flew past the what's Mount Rushmore? I flew past Mount Rushmore in my pits. Like I'm solo and just snapping some shots. I think back in those days I was using like a wind up camera and I took a few pics, but did you get any cool shots along the way? Did you see something that you're saying, man, this is amazing to be flying this airplane along this route and here I am and what's out there? What'd you see?
Well, you know, I think some of the highlights were having my battery die in Kansas and having some locals help me out, you know, with their pickup truck and some jumper cables. They were just really happy to help me out and get me going again. You know, flying through New Mexico was absolutely amazing. Just gorgeous sights and valleys. I got to fly through a canyon. It was just amazing. The terrain features you see through New Mexico and Arizona through Sedona was just incredible. Sedona is very memorable. If anybody is, you know, if you ever had a chance to find a Sedona, it's just breathtaking. Just seeing the Palisades off in the distance and this runway perched on top of this plateau, you know, it's just breathtaking. And then flying through Nevada, then California, just across the open expanse of desert, you know, realizing that there's just nothing out there except for you. It was definitely, once in a lifetime type of experience for me.
Wow. How was it crossing the, let's see. So you, if you started kind of in Illinois and then you had to cross the Rockies at some point, or did you kind of go to this complete southern route? You went kind of around them past El Paso and kind of through that area. Is that kind of the routing?
So it was Iowa, then through Kansas, then New Mexico, Arizona, into California.
So the terrain is still pretty high through there. So for folks that aren't familiar with these routings, as you kind of take off, airliner guys don't think about this at all, do we? When we take off in the jet, we are at cruise altitude by the time we cross the Colorado River, climbing out of 20, 30,000 feet, possibly by that point. And it won't be long now. And we don't even think about the Rockies because they're so far below you. You just go, no problem. But in something like a Pitts, everything counts. Like you can't fly right over the highest point in the Rockies. It's really high. And, you know, we can't fly above 10,000 feet for very long. We can go to 12,500 for a while, but it's in this, in one minor detail, there's no heater and there's no air conditioning. So whatever the temperature it is outside, it's inside, and above 10,000 feet, it's pretty miserable, especially this time of year. How low did you fly most of the way?
You know, it was probably, I was breaking the engine in, so I tried to stay as low as possible. Mm-hmm. There were times when I was about 1,000 feet above the ground.
Awesome. That's the best trip. Wow. So yes. And the other cool thing about the Pitts is I noticed when I flew it, it's like, okay, well maybe if I go higher, I can lean it out a little and pull the throttle back and then I can go to like max endurance. All that does is make that next leg take longer. I'm not going to save any fuel. It doesn't actually help us really at all. I couldn't find what I just figured is 25 square, get the power all the way up, get the highest power setting I can get out of the thing at whatever altitude that is, and lean the mixture to just a touch to keep it from loading up. So, I mean, it just kind of straight out on my EGT, like the 3 o'clock position for what I remember. I wouldn't let it be lean of peak. It'd always be rich of peak slightly and just go as fast as it'll go. And you pretty much ran the same way on the A model?
Yeah, and since I was breaking the engine, I needed to run it hard. So it was exactly that. It was, you know, 25 squared, you know, 65 to 75% power most of the way.
Wow.
And when you get above 5,000 feet, you can't run at those power settings. So fortunately, the first half of the flight, which was all the break-in time anyways, I was able to stay low. And then the second half, the next day, going south, when I had to come up, I did hit altitude as high as 11,000 feet, but just for a short period of time. For the most part, I was able to, you know, keep it below 7,000 feet on the second day. But by then, the airplane was already broken in.
Right, and you have to get over to 7,000 just to clear the dirt in some of these areas, right? The field, I mean, the ground level in through a lot of New Mexico is over 4,000 feet, isn't it? Like through some of the higher terrain through that area.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So, I had to clear some peaks at up around 11,000 feet.
Yeah, it's beautiful through there. I love that routing, and there's some highways too. So when you're flying through these places, it's not completely desolate. Well, actually, it was pretty desolate on the northern route, which I wouldn't recommend. Now that I've done it, that northern tier is pretty desolate, and over by the Tetons in Wyoming, very desolate. And here I am in my pits at 12,000 feet, and thinking to myself, there's no place to go out here. If the motor quits, they'll never find me. So being 26 years old, I probably was taking a little more risk going through that way. But it was beautiful. I'm glad I tried it once. I think going through that direction is probably not that great of an idea for pits. I don't know if there's ever anybody else that's been through that way in a pits before. And there's probably a good reason. Anyway, so the Transcon cross country in a pits is epic. For those of you who haven't done a biplane trip, the first thing I did when I was on my way out to pick up the airplane on the airliner to go pick it up, the one way trip to the East Coast, I read a cool book. I don't know, Art, if you ever read this book. Have you ever read Biplane by Richard Bach?
I have. I'm going to have to check that out.
It's amazing. Look it up on Amazon if you can. Probably pick it up a used copy of it. It's Richard Bach, one of the greatest aviation writers, I believe, of all time. It's tricky to write about aviation. For us pilots, it's not too tricky to talk about it. But writing about it is actually pretty amazing. And I'm not going to spoil the story if you haven't read it. It's a book called Biplane. And since Art and I both flew a biplane across the country and we owned a biplane, and I've owned biplanes for many years, it helps you fall in love with it and all over again for all the right reasons, and the adventure and the excitement of owning a open cockpit biplane and all the things that can happen along the way. It really will make you chuckle and say, yeah, really? Biplanes don't really like crosswinds, do they? Like, biplanes weren't invented for crosswinds. They only like the wind down the runway. Because back in the early days, you just land in a field and point the dang thing into the wind. What's the deal with a crosswind? Like, why would anyone land a biplane with a crosswind? Well, eventually they made concrete, and you can't always line the concrete up with the wind. So anyway, I'm sure you'll enjoy that book. It's a good one, Bach, A Biplane by Richard Bach. Well, that's about all I have. Art, is there any stuff that you can tell the folks where they could reach you, or should we just put the comments and put your contact info in the comment section of our podcast, and also anything else that I may have missed with that story? It's quite an adventure flying that thing across the country with me.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks for bringing me on board to talk about this today, Mike. And I'll definitely leave my contact information in the comment section, and please feel free to reach out. I'd be happy to train you and get you some experience in a pits. You'll love it.
There you go. Another passionate aviator flying a cool airplane. Art's a CFI, a professional airline pilot, loves airplanes. He also flew helicopters at a time. He doesn't really do teaching in that. He's sticking to the cool, fun stuff, the aerobatics in the pits. Give Art a call. And we thank you guys for taking flight with Michael Rocket Blackstone. As we always say, keep on flying, and we'll see you next time.
Take care, Mike. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, brother. Thanks for coming out. Bye-bye.